Hello there, and welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. Second week in a row, some kind of record around here these days. Still a little jet-lagged from a quick trip to Washington, D.C. last week, which was a very good one. I went and spoke at the International Association of Privacy Professionals conference. I gave a keynote address there. It was very good, and then had a separate on-stage conversation with Jeff Jarvis about privacy and disclosure and transparency. And I also got a chance to have dinner with a lot of really nice folks, including John Taylor Williams, who you will know as the sound engineer for this podcast, and Thomas Commandline Gideon, and a few other friends. So I'm back from DC. My wife is coming back today from the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. My daughter is very glad to have her parents around again. She got spoiled rotten by her grandmother, my mother-in-law, for a few days there, but she's very happy to have me back, and she's really looking forward to her mom coming back today too, as am I. So in DC, I had terrible jet lag, so I found myself up at 2 a.m. and wanting to turn the time into productive work. I finished Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, my nonfiction copyright and business book. Few people have been given copies of it, and I've gotten some of my first feedback and done a little bit of a rewrite already today. Still waiting to hear from my agent on it, and we're going to start putting it out to market very soon, I expect. There's a lot of little fact-check notes to myself in there that I'm going to have to go through that'll take a week or so. But I'm giving myself a few days off this week because I could really use it. I've been really working straight out hardcore since, since I came off the crutches back in the spring a year ago. Since then, I've finished 4 novels and this nonfiction book, along with a lot of novellas and many other things. And boy, it's really been a serious year. So yeah, a few days off are definitely in order. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to head down to the Canadian Embassy and renew my passport and my daughter's passport and just do all that housekeeping stuff now that I've cleared my decks a little. Some upcoming speaking gigs. On the 24th of March, I'll be speaking at OrgCon in London, and I'm just one of many headliners on that bill. We'll have Wendy Seltzer and Lawrence Lessig coming in for it. It's a very cheap conference, especially if you're already a member of Org, the Open Rights Group, which is a kind of British equivalent to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and something I hope you'll consider joining. I'm one of the co-founders, although I'm now just on the advisory board. But I really hope you'll find that the work that goes on there is worth supporting. On April 6th to 9th, I'll be in London for the EasterCon, which is the British National Science Fiction Convention, and I'll be one of the guests of honor along with others, including George R.R. Martin, which is pretty cool. And that'll be out by the airport, out by Heathrow. Again, I hope I'll see you there, and I'm going to be reading from Homeland there. This will be the first ever public reading from the sequel to Little Brother. It's very exciting. April 10th to 11th, I'll be at the Kansas Library Association in Wichita, and I'll also be speaking at the Wichita Public Library, and I'll have more details for that as the date draws closer. I'll be going straight from EasterCon, probably stay out at Heathrow and fly straight out back to Kansas for a couple of days. So I haven't been to Kansas in quite some time, and I hope I'll see some of you there in the great Midwest. So today I'm going to read to you from my last Guardian column, which is called Censorship is Inseparable from Surveillance. And the key insight, which is in the title, came to me when I was listening to, well, in fact, I heard Jacob Applebaum say it at the 28th Chaos Communications Congress back in Berlin over Christmas week, where I gave my talk about the war on general purpose computing. So all credit to Jacob for the key insight in this essay. And here we go. There was a time when you could censor without spying. When Britain banned the publication of James Joyce's Ulysses in the 1920s and 30s, the ban took the form of a prohibition on the sale of copies of the books. Theoretically, this entailed opening some imported parcels, and it certainly imposed a constraint on publishers and booksellers. It was undoubtedly awful, but we've got it worse today. Jump forward 80 years. Imagine that you want to ban www.jamesjoycesulysses.com due to a copyright claim from the Joyce estate. Thanks to the Digital Economy Act and the provision it makes for a national British copyright firewall, we're headed for a system where entertainment companies can specify URLs that have infringing websites, and a national censor wall will block everyone in the country from visiting those sites. In order to stop you from visiting www.jamesjoycesulysses.com, The National Sensor Wall must intercept all your outgoing internet requests and examine them to determine whether they are for the banned website. That's the difference between the old days of censorship and our new digital censorship world. Today, censorship is inseparable from surveillance. Of course, you can't surveil without censorship, watching everything and stopping nothing. Ironically, from a human rights perspective, censorship with surveillance is better than censorship on its own. In despotic regimes around the world, censorship is the spur that gets internet users to use Tor, the onion router, a technology for bypassing censor walls that offers some anonymity in the bargain. When the government in Syria or Iran blocks Facebook or Human Rights Watch, internet users figure out how to install and use Tor, and their browsing habits are kept private from the secret police. When the state drops the censorship, many users drop Tor, which slows down your internet connection, and then everything they do is visible to the agents of the state who might kidnap, torture, and kill them for looking at the wrong parts of the internet. We hear a lot about the death of privacy and the supposed end of our desire to be private. I think it's more correct to say that we're very bad at pricing the long-term option on a present-day privacy disclosure. That's because privacy trade-offs are one of those areas of public life where actions and consequences are separated by a lot of time and space. That's a recipe for a problem that's nearly impossible to get good at solving. To understand why, think of the old days of film cameras. In those days, most families shot one or two rolls of film a year, one on the family vacation and one through Christmas and birthdays, more or less. You'd send the film off to the lab for photo processing, sometimes months after the exposures were shot, and you get back your pictures. Most would be mediocre, some would be terrible, and a few would be wonderful. But unless you went to extraordinary lengths to record the circumstances of each shot, you would almost certainly have no idea what you did to make the good ones good and the bad ones bad. Without that vital knowledge about causes and effects, it is impossible to improve at any task. The easiest way to cultivate a knowledge of cause and effect is to move the two closer together. When digital cameras arrived on the scene, they were inferior to film cameras in many ways, but they had an immediacy that film cameras had never managed. Even instant Polaroid cameras couldn't compare with the feedback that digital cameras gave. As soon as you press the shutter button, your image appears on the viewfinder. Even though digital cameras lack the resolution of film cameras, most of us amateurs make better photos with them than we ever did with our film cameras. Merely being able to marry cause and effect does that. As a society, we've gotten so good at taking photos that now we buy products like Hipstamatic that degrade our pictures to make them look more authentic, in part because our casual snaps are so well framed and timed that they have the look of a studio portrait. Adding grain, blur, and color imbalances restores the sense that they are genuine, spontaneous shots. We lack any effective means of moving cause and effect together for privacy, especially for the worst kind of privacy disasters. In the early 1980s, I had a teacher whose wife went into hospital to deliver their first child. Afterwards, they were approached by a nice man from a marketing consortium, offering a basket of free nappies, baby grows, wipes, and other necessities. All he wanted in return was the child's name, date of birth, and address, details that privacy detractors trivialize as tombstone information. They gave it to him. A few weeks later, the baby died. It was unforeseen and tragic. More tragic, though, was what happened every year on the child's birthday. The grieving family got a slew of commercial offers in the post, targeted at the dead child's aging ghost. Few of us would have the foresight to turn down a basket of freebies on the grounds that our newborn first child might suddenly die. It's not the sort of thing that we are likely to turn our minds to as we recover in a maternity ward. Of course, once the lesson of the downside of this sort of disclosure has been learned, we're not likely to forget it. But how many times in our lives do we get to apply the lesson? Will we be clever and insightful enough to apply the lesson the next time someone offers us an unrelated privacy bargain, like a Boots reward card? Privacy isn't the only problem that is widespread, potentially grave, and characterized by the separation of cause and effect. In fact, these are the traits that unite our most pernicious public health problems. No one would smoke if the tumors emerged with the first drag. No one would overeat if every mouthful of cheesecake was instantly transformed into an equivalent volume of cellulite on your thighs or stomach. No one would drink to excess if the hangover started while you were hoisting your first pint of the evening. Many people who smoke will never develop cancer. Many people who eat cheesecake have the BMI of a ballerina. Many people who drink never get drunk. But for people who do experience problems, the consequences are grave, even deadly. Likewise, many people who deliberately or inadvertently disclose their private information will never suffer any particularly grave consequences. But the worst failures of privacy disclosure will be just as grave as in other public health problems. Bankruptcy, identity theft, even danger of violence in the case of Iranian dissidents who allow themselves to be snooped upon by the national firewall. There are plenty of services that make healthy profits off of this unfortunate dynamic. The existence of overeating doesn't mean that people don't care about obesity. The success of the tobacco industry doesn't mean that people don't care about cancer. And the existence of widespread privacy disclosures online doesn't mean that people don't care about privacy. Governments put a lot of energy into tackling public health problems. They regulate the companies that profit from the problems by instituting a minimum drinking age, prohibiting public smoking, and so on, and conduct public education campaigns to help people appreciate the potential future effects of their present-day causes. Reflecting the difficulty of such problems, governments often turn to lurid, disturbing imagery, such as graphic photos of diseased lungs or shock adverts depicting the dangers of drunkenness. Imagine instead that the government spent an equivalent amount of money to make the problem worse. Imagine that the state used its tax coffers to ensure that cigarette vending machines were placed into every school. Imagine that they instituted a nationwide two-drink minimum for people stopping in at petrol stations or riding the buses. Fundamentally, this is what national censorship regimes accomplish. They require us to disclose our every online click and keystroke to the state and the private companies that operate the censorship mechanisms it employs. They especially require this of our children, particularly in schools and libraries. It's often the case that the companies that supply censorware to schools, libraries, and parents are the very same that serve autocrats from Burma to Bahrain, repackaging their code and their blacklist for sale in liberal democracies' educational institutions. Most of the privacy disclosures made by most of the internet's users will not harm them in any way. But we all make so many disclosures so often that it's only a matter of time until each of us comes up against the difficulty of getting better at privacy. We need the state to help us fight the public health problem, to encourage the use of tools that promote privacy online, to deliver the technical skills to help each child operate her computer and browser in a way that puts her in charge of how her information is disclosed as she moves through the web. We need them to remind us all that this stuff matters, and to pause and think through our information habits and consider the ways that they might come back to bite us in the future. We can't do this at the same time as we are nationally discounting the value of all private information to zero. We can't tell people to value their privacy and treat it as valueless. Well, we can, but only if we don't actually care about the harms that arise from privacy breaches. Only if we want to make people don't care about privacy into our national mission statement. All right, then. Talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ours, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.